This is Audible.
Penguin Audiobooks presents No Second Chance by Harlan Coben. Read by Scott Brick. Chapter 1. When the first bullet hit my chest, I thought of my daughter. At least that's what I want to believe. I lost consciousness pretty fast. And if you want to get technical about it, I don't even remember being shot. I know that I lost a lot of blood. I know that a second bullet skimmed the top of my head, though I was probably already out by then. I know that my heart stopped. But I still like to think that as I lay dying, I thought of Tara. FYI, I saw no bright light or tunnel. Or if I did, I don't remember that either. Tara, my daughter, is only 6 months old. She was lying in her crib. I wonder if the gunfire frightened her. It must have. She probably began to cry. I wonder if the familiar, albeit grating, sound of her cries somehow sliced through my haze, if on some level I actually heard her. But again, I have no memory of it. What I do remember, however, was the moment Tara was born. I remember Monica. That's Tara's mother, bearing down for one last push. I remember the head appearing. I was the first to see my daughter. We all know about life's forks in the road. We all know about opening one door and closing another. Life cycles, the changes in seasons. But the moment your child is born, it's beyond surreal. You have walked through a Star Trek-like portal, a full-fledged reality transformer. Everything is different. You are different, a simple element hit with a startling catalyst and metamorphosed into one far more complex. Your world is gone. It shrinks down to the dimensions of, in this case anyway, a 6-pound, 15-ounce mass. Fatherhood confuses me. Yes, I know that with only 6 months on the job, I am an amateur. My best friend Lenny has 4 kids, a girl and 3 boys. His oldest, Marianne, is 10. His youngest just turned 1. With his face permanently set on happily harried and the floor of his SUV permanently stained with congealed fast food, Lenny reminds me that I know nothing yet. I agree. But when I get seriously lost or afraid in the realm of raising a child, I look at the helpless bundle in the crib and she looks up at me, and I wonder what I would not do to protect her. I would lay down my life in a second. And truth be told, if push came to shove, I would lay down yours too. So I like to think that as the 2 bullets pierced my body, as I collapsed onto the linoleum of my kitchen floor with a half-eaten granola bar clutched in my hand, as I lay immobile in a spreading puddle of my own blood, and yes, even as my heart stopped beating, that I still tried to do something to protect my daughter. I came to in the dark. I had no idea where I was at first, but then I heard the beeping coming from my right. A familiar sound. I did not move. I merely listened to the beeps. My brain felt as if it had been marinated in molasses. The first impulse to break through was a primitive one. Thirst. I craved water. I had never known a throat could feel so dry. I tried to call out, but my tongue had been dry caked to the bottom of my mouth. A figure entered the room. When I tried to sit up, hot pain ripped like a knife down my neck. My head fell back. And again, there was darkness. When I awoke again, it was daytime. Harsh streaks of sunlight slashed through the Venetian blinds. I blinked through them. Part of me wanted to raise my hand and block the rays, but exhaustion would not let the command travel. My throat was still impossibly parched. I heard a movement, and suddenly there was a woman standing over me. I looked up and saw a nurse. The perspective, so different from the one I was used to, threw me. Nothing felt right. I was supposed to be the one standing looking down, not the other way around. A white hat, one of those small, harshly triangular numbers, sat like a bird's nest on the nurse's head. I've spent a great deal of my life working in a wide variety of hospitals, but I'm not sure I've ever seen a hat like that outside of TV or the movies. The nurse was heavyset and black. Dr. Seidman, her voice was warm maple syrup. I managed a very slight nod. The nurse must have read minds because she already had a cup of water in her hand. She put the straw between my lips, and I sucked greedily. "Slow down," she said gently. I was going to ask where I was, but that seemed pretty obvious. I opened my mouth to find out what had happened, but again, she was one step ahead of me. "I'll go get the doctor," she said, heading for the door. "You just relax now." I croaked, "My family. I'll be right back. Try not to worry." I let my eyes wander about the room. My vision had that medicated shower curtain haze. Still, there were enough stimuli getting through to make certain deductions. I was in a typical hospital room. That much was obvious. There was a drip bag and IV pump on my left, the tubes snaking down to my arm. The fluorescent bulbs buzzed almost, but not quite imperceptibly. A small TV on a swinging arm jutted out from the upper right-hand corner. A few feet past the foot of the bed, there was a large glass window. I squinted but could not see through it. Still, I was probably being monitored. That meant I was in an ICU. That meant that whatever was wrong with me was something pretty bad. The top of my skull itched, and I could feel a pull at my hair. Bandaged, I bet. I tried to check myself out, but my head really did not want to cooperate. Dull pain quietly boomed inside me, though I couldn't tell from where it originated. My limbs felt heavy, my chest encased in lead. "Dr. Seidman," I flicked my eyes toward the door. A tiny woman in surgical scrubs, complete with a shower cap, stepped into the room. The top of the mask was untied and dangled down her neck. I am 34 years old. She looked about the same. "I'm Dr. Heller," she said, stepping closer. "Ruth Heller." Giving me her first name. Professional courtesy, no doubt. Ruth Heller gave me a probing stare. I tried to focus. My brain was still sluggish, but I could feel it sputtering to life. "You are at St. Elizabeth Hospital," she said in a properly grave voice. The door behind her opened and a man stepped inside. It was hard to see him clearly through the shower curtain haze, but I don't think I knew him. The man crossed his arms and leaned against the wall with practiced casualness. "Not a doctor," I thought. "You work with them long enough, you can tell." Dr. Heller gave the man a cursory glance, and then she turned her full attention back to me. "What happened?" I asked. "You were shot," she said, then added, "twice." She let that hang for a moment. I glanced toward the man against the wall. He hadn't moved. I opened my mouth to say something, but Ruth Heller pressed on. "One bullet grazed the top of your head. The bullet literally scraped off your scalp, which, as you probably know, is incredibly rich with blood." Yes, I knew. Serious scalp wounds bled like beheadings. Okay, I thought that explained the itch on top of my head. When Ruth Heller hesitated, I prompted her. "And the second bullet?" Heller let out a breath. "That one was a bit more complicated." I waited. "The bullet entered your chest and nicked the pericardial sac. That caused a large supply of blood to leak into the space between your heart and the sac. The EMTs had trouble locating your vital signs. You had to crack your chest. Doc, the leaning man interrupted, and for a moment I thought he was talking to me. Ruth Heller stopped, clearly annoyed. The man peeled himself off the wall. Can you do the details later? Time is of the essence here. She gave him a scowl, but there wasn't much behind it. I'll stay here and observe, she said to the man, if that's not a problem. Dr. Heller faded back, and now the man loomed over me. His head was too big for his shoulders, so that you feared his neck would collapse from the weight of it. His hair was crew-cut all around, except in the front where it hung down in a Caesar line above his eyes. A soul patch, an ugly smear of growth, sat on his chin like a burrowing insect. All in all, he looked like a member of a boy band gone to serious seed. He smiled down at me, but there was no warmth behind it. I'm Detective Bob Regan of the Caselton Police Department, he said. I know you're confused right now. My family, I began. I'll get to that, he interrupted. But right now, I need to ask you some questions, okay? Before we get into the details of what happened. He waited for a response. I tried my best to clear the cobwebs and said, okay. What's the last thing you remember? I scanned my memory banks. I remembered waking up that morning, getting dressed. I remembered looking in on Tara. I remembered turning the knob on her black and white mobile, a gift from a colleague who insisted it would help stimulate a baby's brain or something. The mobile hadn't moved or bleated out its tinny song. The batteries were dead. I'd made a mental note to put in new ones. I headed downstairs after that. Eating a granola bar, I said. Regan nodded as if he'd expected this answer. You were in the kitchen? Yes, by the sink. And then? I tried harder, but nothing came. I shook my head. I woke up once before, at night. I was here, I think. Nothing else? I reached out again, but to no avail. No, nothing. Regan flipped out a pad. Like the doc here told you, you were shot twice. You have no recollection of seeing a gun or hearing a shot or anything like that? No. That's understandable, I guess. You were in a bad way, Mark. The EMTs thought you were a goner. My throat felt dry again. Where are Tara and Monica? Stay with me, Mark. Regan was staring down at the pad, not at me. I felt the dread begin to press down on my chest. Did you hear a window break? I felt groggy. I tried to read the label on the drip bag to see what they were numbing me with. No go. Pain medication at the very least. Probably morphine in the IV pump. I tried to fight through the effects. No, I said. You're sure? We found a broken window near the rear of the house. It may have been how the perpetrator gained entry. I don't remember a window breaking, I said. Do you know who? Regan cut me off. Not yet, no. That's why I'm here asking these questions, to find out who did this. He looked up from his pad. Do you have any enemies? Did he really just ask me that? I tried to sit up, tried to gain some sort of angle on him, but there was no way that was going to happen. I did not like being the patient on the wrong end of the bed, if you will. They say doctors make the worst patients. This sudden role reversal is probably why. I want to know about my wife and daughter. I understand that, Regan said, and something in his tone ran a cold finger across my heart. But you can't afford the distraction, Mark. not right yet. You want to be helpful, right? Then you need to stay with me here. He went back to the pad. Now, what about enemies? Arguing with him any further seemed futile or even harmful, so I grudgingly acquiesced. Someone who would shoot me? Yes. No, no one. And your wife? His eyes settled hard on me. A favorite image of Monica. Her face lighting up when we first saw Raymond Kill Falls. The way she threw her arms around me in mock fear as the water crashed around us rose like an apparition. Did she have enemies? I looked at him. Monica? Ruth Heller stepped forward. I think that might be enough for now. What happened to Monica? I asked. Dr. Heller met up with Detective Regan, standing shoulder to shoulder. Both looked at me. Heller started to protest again, but I stopped her. Don't give me this protect the patient crap, I tried to shout, fear and fury battling against whatever had put my brain in this fuzz. Tell me what happened to my wife. She's dead, Detective Regan said. Just like that. Dead. My wife. Monica. It was as if I hadn't heard him. The word couldn't reach me. When the police broke into your home, you had both been shot. They were able to save you, but it was too late for your wife. I'm sorry. There was another quick flash now. Monica at Martha's Vineyard, on the beach, tan bathing suit, that black hair whipping across those cheekbones, giving me the razor-sharp smile. I blinked it away. And Tara? Your daughter, Regan began with a quick throat clear. He looked at his pad again, but I don't think he planned on writing anything down. She was home that morning, correct? I mean, at the time of the incident. Yes, of course. Where is she? Regan closed the pad with a snap. She was not at the scene when we arrived. My lungs turned to stone. I don't understand. We originally hoped that maybe she was in the care of a family member, a friend, a babysitter even, but... His voice faded. Are you telling me you don't know where Tara is? There was no hesitation this time. Yes, that's correct. It felt as if a giant hand were pushing down on my chest. I squeezed my eyes shut and fell back. How long? I asked. Has she been missing? Yes. Dr. Heller started speaking too quickly. You have to understand, you were very seriously injured. We were not optimistic you would survive. You were on a respirator. A lung collapsed. You also contracted sepsis. You're a doctor, so I know I don't have to explain to you how serious that is. We tried to slow down the meds, help you wake up. How long? I asked again. She and Regan exchanged another glance, and then Heller said something that ripped the air out of me all over again. You've been out for 12 days. Chapter 2. We're doing all we can, Regan said in a voice that sounded too rehearsed, as if he'd been standing over my bed while I was unconscious, working on its delivery. As I told you, we were not sure we had a missing child at first. We lost valuable time there, but we've recovered now. Tara's photo has been sent out to every police station, airport, toll booth plaza, bus and train station. Anything like that within 100-mile radius. We've run background profiles on similar abduction cases, see if we can find a pattern or a suspect. 12 days, I repeated. You have a trace on your various phones. Home, business, cell. Why? In case someone calls in a ransom demand, he said. Have there been any calls? Not yet, no. My head dropped back to the pillow. 12 days. I'd been lying in this bed for 12 days. Well, my baby girl was... I pushed the thought away. Regan scratched at his beard. Do you remember what Tara was wearing that morning? I did. I had developed something of a morning routine. Wake up early, tiptoe toward Tara's crib, stare down. A baby is not all joy. I know that. I know that there are moments of mind-numbing boredom. I know that there are nights when her screams work on my nerve endings like a cheese grater. I don't want to glorify life with an infant. But I liked my new morning routine. Looking down at Tara's tiny form fortified me somehow. More than that, this act was, I guess, a form of rapture. Some people find rapture in a house of worship. Me? And yeah, I know how corny this sounds. I found rapture in that crib. A pink one-piece with black penguins, I said. Monica got it at Baby Gap. He jotted it down. And Monica? What about her? His face was back in the pad. What was she wearing? Jeans, I said, remembering the way they slid over Monica's hips. And a red blouse. Regan jotted some more. I said, are there... I mean, do you have any leads? We're still investigating all avenues. That's not what I asked. Regan just looked at me. There was too much weight in that stare. My daughter. Out there, alone. For 12 days. I thought of her eyes, the warm light only a parent sees, and I said something stupid. She's alive. Regan tilted his head like a puppy hearing a new sound. Don't give up, I said. We won't. He continued with the curious look. It's just that... Are you a parent, Detective Regan? Two girls, he said. It's stupid, but I'd know. The same way I knew the world would never be the same when Tara was born. I'd know, I said again. He did not reply. I realized that what I was saying, especially coming from a man who scoffs at the notions of ESP or the supernatural or miracles, was ridiculous. I knew that this sense merely came from want. You want to believe so badly that your brain rearranges what it sees. But I clung to it anyway. Right or wrong, it felt like a lifeline. We'll need some more information from you, Regan said. About you, your wife, friends, finances. Later. It was Dr. Heller again. She moved forward as if to block me from his gaze. Her voice was firm. He needs to rest. No. Now, I said to her, upping the firmometer a notch past hers. We need to find my daughter. Monica had been buried at the Portman family plot on her father's estate. I missed her funeral, of course. I don't know how I felt about that, but then again, my feelings for my wife in those stark moments when I was honest with myself have always been muddled. Monica had that beauty of privilege what with two fine cheekbones, straight silk black hair, and that country club lockjaw that both annoyed and aroused. Our marriage was an old-fashioned one. Shotgun. Okay, that's an exaggeration. Monica was pregnant. I was fence-sitting. The upcoming arrival tilted me into the matrimonial pasture. I heard the funeral details from Carson Portman, Monica's uncle and the only member of her family who kept in touch with us. Monica had loved him dearly. Carson sat at my hospital bedside with his hands folded in his lap. He looked very much like your favorite college professor, what with the thick-lensed spectacles, the nearly shedding tweed coat, and the overgrown shock of Albert Einstein meets Don King hair. But his brown eyes glistened as he told me in his sad baritone that Edgar, Monica's father, had made sure that my wife's funeral was a small, tasteful affair. Of that I had no doubt. The small part, at least. Over the next few days, I had my share of visitors at the hospital. My mother, everyone called her Honey, exploded into my room every morning as if fuel-propelled. She wore Reebok sneakers of pure white. Her sweatsuit was blue with gold trim, as if she coached the St. Louis Rams. Her hair, though neatly coiffed, had the brittle of too many colorings, and there was the whiff of a last cigarette about her. Mom's makeup did little to disguise the anguish of losing her only grandchild. She had amazing energy, staying by my bedside day after day and managing to exude a steady stream of hysteria. This was good. It was as though she was in part being hysterical for me, and thus, in a strange way, her eruptions of emotion kept me calm. Despite the room's nearly supernova heat and my constant protestations, Mom would put an extra blanket over me when I was asleep. I woke up one time, my body drenched in sweat, naturally, to hear my mother telling the black nurse with the formal hat about my previous stay at St. Elizabeth's when I was only 7. "He had salmonella," Honey stated in a conspiratorial whisper that was only slightly louder than a bullhorn. "You never smelled diarrhea like that. It was just pouring out of him. His stench practically seeped into the wallpaper." "He ain't all roses now, either," the nurse replied. The two women shared a laugh. On day 2 of my recovery, Mom was standing over my bed when I awoke. "Remember this?" she said. She was holding a stuffed Oscar the Grouch someone had given me during that salmonella stay. The green had faded to a light mint. She looked at the nurse. "This is Mark's Oscar," she explained. "Mom," I said. She turned her attention back to me. The mascara was a little too heavy today, crinkling into the wrinkle lines. "Oscar kept you company back then, remember? He helped you get better." I rolled and then closed my eyes. A memory came to me. I had gotten the salmonella from raw eggs. My father used to add them into milkshakes for the protein. I remember the way pure terror had gripped me when I'd first learned that I would have to stay in the hospital overnight. My father, who had recently ruptured his Achilles tendon playing tennis, was in a cast and constant pain. But he saw my fear, and as always, he made the sacrifice. He worked all that day at the plant and spent all night in a chair by my hospital bed. I stayed at St. Elizabeth's for 10 days. My father slept in that chair every night of them. Mom suddenly turned away, and I could see she was remembering the same thing. The nurse quickly excused herself. I put a hand on my mother's back. She didn't move, but I could feel her shudder. She stared down at the faded Oscar in her hands. I slowly took it from her. "Thank you," I said. Mom wiped her eyes. Dad, I knew, would not come to the hospital this time. And while I am sure my mother had told him what had happened, there was no way to know if he even understood. My father had had his first stroke when he was 41 years old, 1 year after staying those nights with me at the hospital. I was 8 at the time. I also have a younger sister, Stacy, who is either a substance abuser, for the more politically correct, or crackhead, for the more accurate. I sometimes look at old pictures from before my dad's stroke. The ones with the young, confident family of four and the shaggy dog and the well-groomed lawn and the basketball hoop and the coal-overloaded, lighter-saturated barbecue. I look for hints of the future in my sister's front-teeth-missing smile, her shadow self, perhaps. A sense of foreboding. But I see none. We still have the house, but it's like a sagging movie prop. Dad is still alive, but when he fell, everything shattered Humpty Dumpty style. Especially Stacy. Stacy had not visited or even called. But nothing she does surprises me anymore. My mother finally turned to face me. I gripped the faded Oscar a little tighter as a thought struck me anew. It was just us again. Dad was pretty much a vegetable. Stacy was hollowed out, gone. I reached out and took Mom's hand, feeling both the warmth and the more recent thickening of her skin. We stayed like that until the door opened. The same nurse leaned into the room. Mom straightened up and said, "Mark also played with dolls." "Action figures," I said, quick on the correction. They were action figures, not dolls. My best friend Lenny and his wife Cheryl also stopped by the hospital every day. Lenny Marcus is a big-time trial lawyer, though he also handles my small-time stuff, like the time I fought a speeding ticket and the closing on our house. When he graduated and began working for the county prosecutor, friends and opponents quickly dubbed Lenny the Bulldog because of his aggressive courtroom behavior. Somewhere along the line, it was decided that the name was too mild for Lenny, so now they called him Cujo. I've known Lenny since elementary school. I'm the godfather of his son, Kevin. And Lenny is Tara's godfather. I haven't slept much. I lie at night and stare at the ceiling and count the beeps and listen to the hospital night sounds and try very much not to let my mind wander to my little daughter and the endless array of possibilities. I am not always successful. The mind, I have learned, is indeed a dark, snake-infested pit. Detective Regan visited later with a possible lead. "Tell me about your sister," he began. "Why?" I said too quickly. Before he could elaborate, I held up my hand to stop him. I understood. My sister was an addict. Where drugs roamed, so too did a certain criminal element. "Were we robbed?" I asked. "We don't think so. Nothing seems to be missing, but the place was tossed." "Tossed?" "Someone made a mess." "Any thoughts on why?" "No." "So tell me about your sister." "You have Stacy's record?" I asked. "We do." "I'm not sure what I can add." "You two were estranged, correct?" "Estranged." Did that apply to Stacy and me? I love her, I said slowly. And when was the last time you saw her? 6 months ago, when Tara was born. Yes. Where? Where did I see her? Yes. Stacy came to the hospital, I said. To see her niece. Yes. What happened during that visit? Stacy was high. She wanted to hold the baby. You refused? That's right. Did she get angry? She barely reacted. My sister is pretty flat when she's stoned. But you threw her out. I told her she couldn't be a part of Tara's life until she was clean. I see, he said. You were hoping that would force her back into rehab. I might have chuckled. No, not really. I'm not sure I understand. I wondered how to put this. I thought of the smile in the family photo, the one without the front teeth. We've threatened Stacy with worse, I said. The truth is that my sister won't quit. The drugs are part of her. So you hold out no hope for recovery. There was no way I was about to voice that. I didn't trust her with my daughter, I said. Let's leave it at that. Regan headed over to the window and looked out. When did you move into your current residence? Monica and I bought the house 4 months ago. Not far from where you both grew up, no? That's right. Had you two known each other long? I was puzzled by the line of questioning. No. Even though you grew up in the same town. We traveled in different circles. I see, he said. And just so I have it straight, you bought your house 4 months ago and you hadn't seen your sister in 6 months, correct? Correct. So your sister has never visited you at your current residence? That's right. Regan turned to me. We found a set of Stacy's fingerprints at your house. I said nothing. You don't seem surprised, Mark. Stacy is an addict. I don't think she's capable of shooting me and kidnapping my daughter, but I've underestimated how low she could sink before. Did you check her apartment? No one has seen her since you were shot, he said. I closed my eyes. We don't think your sister could pull off something like this by herself, he went on. She might have had an accomplice. A boyfriend, a dealer. Someone who knew your wife was from a wealthy family. Do you have any thoughts? No, I said. So, what, you think this whole thing was a kidnapping plot? Regan started clawing at his soul patch again. Then he gave a small shrug. But they tried to kill us both, I went on. How do you collect ransom from dead parents? They could have been so doped up that they made a mistake, he said. Or maybe they thought they could extort money from Tara's grandfather. So why haven't they yet? Regan did not reply. But I knew the answer. The heat, especially after the shooting, would be too much for crackheads. Crackheads don't handle conflict well. It is one of the reasons they snort or shoot themselves up in the first place. To escape. To fade away. To avoid. To dive down into the white. The media would be all over this case. The police would be making inquiries. Crackheads would freak under that kind of pressure. They would flee. Abandon everything. and they would get rid of all the evidence. But the ransom demand came 2 days later. Now that I had regained consciousness, my recovery from the gunshot wounds was proceeding with surprising smoothness. It could be that I was focused on getting better, or that lying in a quasi-catatonic state for 12 days had given my injuries time to heal. Or it could be that I was suffering from a pain way beyond what the physical could inflict. I would think of Tara, and the fear of the unknown would stop my breath. I would think of Monica, of her lying dead, and steel claws would shred me from within. I wanted out. My body still ached, but I pressed Ruth Heller to release me. Noting that I was proving the adage about doctors making the worst patients, she reluctantly gave me the okay to go home. We agreed that a physical therapist would come by every day. A nurse would pop by periodically, just to be on the safe side. On the morning of my departure from St. Elizabeth, my mother was at the house. The former crime scene, getting it ready for me, whatever that meant. Oddly enough, I wasn't afraid to go back there. The house is mortar and brick. I didn't think the sight of it alone would move me, but maybe I was just blocking. Lenny helped me pack and get dressed. He is tall and wiry, with a face darkened by a Homer Simpson 5 o'clock shadow that pops up 6 minutes after he shaves. As a child, Lenny wore Coke bottle glasses and too thick corduroy, even in the summer. His curly hair had a habit of getting outgrown to the point where he'd start resembling a stray poodle. Now he keeps the curls religiously close-cropped. He had laser eye surgery 2 years ago, so the glasses are gone. His suits lean toward the upscale side. "You sure you won't stay with us?" Lenny said. "You have 4 kids," I reminded him. "Oh, yeah, right." He paused. "Can I stay with you?" I tried to smile. "Seriously," Lenny said, "you shouldn't be alone in that house." "I'll be fine. Cheryl cooked you some dinners. She put them in the freezer." "That was nice of her." "She's still the world's most god-awful cook," Lenny said. "I didn't say I was going to eat them." Lenny looked away, busying himself with the already packed bag. I watched him. "We have known each other a long time, since Mrs. Roberts' first grade class, so it probably did not surprise him when I said, 'You want to tell me what's up?'" He'd been waiting for the opening and thus quickly exploited it. "Look, I'm your lawyer, right?" "Right. So I want to give you some legal advice." "I'm listening." I should have said something earlier, but I knew you wouldn't listen. Now it's a different story, I think. "Lenny?" "Yeah? What are you talking about?" Despite his physical enhancements, I still saw Lenny as a kid. It made it hard to take his advice too seriously. Don't get me wrong. I knew that he was smart. I had celebrated with him when he got his acceptance to Princeton and then Columbia Law. We took the SATs together and were in the same AP chemistry class our junior year. But the Lenny I saw was the one I desperately cruised with on muggy Friday and Saturday nights. We used his dad's wood-paneled station wagon. Not exactly a babe trawler, and tried to hit the parties. We were always let in, but never really welcome. Members of that high school majority I call the Great Unseen. We would stand in corners, holding a beer, bopping our heads to the music, trying hard to be noticed. We never were. Most nights we ended up eating a grilled cheese at the Heritage Diner, or better, at the soccer field behind Benjamin Franklin Middle School, lying on our backs, checking out the stars. It was easier to talk, even with your best friend, when you were looking at the stars. Okay, Lenny said, over-gesturing as was his custom. It's like this. I don't want you talking to the cops anymore without my being present. I frowned. For real? Maybe it's nothing, but I've seen cases like this. Not like this, but you know what I mean. The first suspect is always family. Meaning my sister. No, meaning close family. Or closer family, if possible. Are you saying the police suspect me? I don't know. I really don't. He paused, but not for very long. Okay, yeah, probably. But I was shot, remember? My kid was the one taken. Right, and that cuts both ways. How do you figure that? As the days pass, they're going to start suspecting you more and more. Why? I asked. I don't know. That's just how it works. Look, the FBI handles kidnappings. You know that, right? Once a child is gone 24 hours, they assume it's interstate and the case is theirs. So for the first, 10 days or so, they had a ton of agents here. They monitored your phones and waited for the ransom call, that kind of thing. But the other day, they pretty much pulled up stakes. That's normal, of course. They can't wait indefinitely, so they scale back to an agent or two. And their thinking shifted, too. Terra became less a possible kidnapping for ransom and more a straight-on abduction. But my guess is they still have the taps on the phones. I haven't asked yet, but I will. They'll claim they're leaving them there in case a ransom demand is eventually made, but they'll also be hoping to hear you say something incriminating. So be careful, Lenny said. Remember that your phones, home, biz, cell, are probably tapped. And again, I ask, so? I didn't do anything. Didn't do? Lenny waved his hands as if preparing to take flight. Look, just be careful is all. This might be hard for you to believe, but... And try not to gasp when I say this. The police have been known to twist and distort evidence. You're confusing me. Are you saying I'm a suspect simply because I'm the father and husband? Yes, Lenny said. And no. Well, okay. Thanks. That clears it up. A phone next to my bed rang. I was on the wrong side of the room. You mind? I said. Lenny picked it up. Dr. Seidman's room? His face clouded over as he listened. He spat out the words, "Hold on," and handed the phone to me as if it might have germs. I gave him a puzzled look and said, "Hello?" "Hello, Mark. This is Edgar Portman. Monica's father." That explained Lenny's reaction. Edgar's voice was, as always, way too formal. Some people weigh their words. A select few, like my father-in-law, take each one and put it on a scale before letting it leave their mouths. I was momentarily taken aback. "Hello, Edgar," I said, stupidly. "How are you?" "I'm fine, thank you. I feel remiss, of course, for not having called you earlier. I understood from Carson that you were busy recuperating from your wounds. I felt it best if I let you be." "Thoughtful," I said, with nary a whiff of sarcasm. Yes, well, I understand you're being released today. That's right. Edgar cleared his throat, which seemed out of character for him. I was wondering if perhaps you could stop by the house. The house, meaning his. Today? As soon as possible, yes. And alone, please. There was silence. Lenny gave me a puzzled look. Is something wrong, Edgar? I asked. I have a car waiting downstairs, Mark. We'll talk more when you arrive. And then, before I could say another word, he was gone. The car, a black Lincoln Town car, was indeed waiting. Lenny wheeled me outside. I was familiar with this area, of course. I had grown up scant miles from St. Elizabeth. When I was 5 years old, my father had rushed me to the emergency room here. 12 stitches. And when I was 7, well, you already know too much about my salmonella visit. I'd gone to medical school and did my residency at what was then called Columbia Presbyterian in New York, but I returned to St. Elizabeth for a fellowship in ophthalmology for reconstruction. Yes, I am a plastic surgeon, but not in the way you think. I do the occasional nose job, but you won't find me working with sacks of silicone or any of that. Not that I'm judging. It just isn't what I do. I work in pediatric reconstructive surgery with my former medical school classmate, a fireball from the Bronx named Zia LaRue. We work for a group called One World Rap Aid together. Actually, Zia and I founded it. We take care of children, mostly overseas, who suffer deformities either through birth, poverty, or conflict. We travel a lot. I have worked on facial smashes in Sierra Leone, on cleft palates in Upper Mongolia, on cruzons in Cambodia, on burn victims in the Bronx. Like most people in my field, I've done extensive training. I've studied ENT, ear, nose, and throat, with a year of reconstructive, plastics, oral, and, as I mentioned before, ophthalmology. Zia's training history is similar, though she's stronger with a maxillofacial. You may think of us as do-gooders. You'd be wrong. I had a choice. I could do boob jobs or tuck back the skin of those who were already too beautiful, or I could help wounded, poverty-stricken children. I chose the latter, not so much to help the disadvantaged, but alas, because that is where the cool cases lie. Most reconstructive surgeons are, at heart, puzzle lovers. We're weird. We get jazzed on circus sideshow congenital anomalies and huge tumors. You know those medical textbooks that have hideous facial deformities that you have to dare yourself to look at? Zia and I love that stuff. We get off on repairing it, taking what's shattered and making it whole even more. The fresh air tickled my lungs. The sun shone as if it were the first day, mocking my gloom. I tilted my face toward the sun and let it soothe me. Monica used to like to do that. She claimed that it de-stressed her. The lines in her face would disappear as if the rays were gentle masseurs. I kept my eyes closed. Lenny waited in silence, giving me the time. I have always thought of myself as an overly sensitive man. I cry too easily at dumb movies. My emotions are easily manipulated. But with my father, I never cried. And now with this terrible blow, I felt, I don't know, beyond tears. A classic defense mechanism, I assumed. I had to push forward. It's not so different from my business. When cracks appear, I patch them up before they become full-fledged fissures. Lenny was still fuming from the phone call. Any idea what that old bastard wants? Not a one. He was quiet a moment. I know what he was thinking. Lenny blamed Edgar for his father's death. His old man had been a middle manager at Pro-Ness Foods, one of Edgar's holdings. He had slaved for the company 26 years and had just turned 52 years old when Edgar orchestrated a major merger. Lenny's father lost his job. I remember seeing Mr. Marcus sitting slump-shouldered at the kitchen table, meticulously stuffing his resume into envelopes. He never found work, and died 2 years later of a heart attack. Nothing could convince Lenny that the two events were unrelated. He said, "You sure you don't want me to come?" "Nah, I'll be all right." "Got your cell?" I showed it to him. "Call me if you need anything." I thanked him and let him walk away. The driver opened the door. I winced my way in. The drive was not far. Caselton, New Jersey. My hometown. We passed the split levels of the 60s, the expanded ranches of the 70s, the aluminum sidings of the 80s, the McMansions of the 90s. Eventually, the trees grew denser. The houses sat farther back from the road, protected by the lush, away from the great unwashed who might happen by. We were nearing old wealth now, that exclusive land that always smelled of autumn and wood smoke. The Portman family had first settled in this thicket immediately following the Civil War. Like most of suburban Jersey, this had been farmland. Great-great-grandfather Portman slowly sold off acreage and made a fortune. They still had 16 acres, making their lot one of the largest in the area. As we climbed the drive, my eyes drifted left, toward the family burial plot. I could see a small mound of fresh dirt. "Stop the car," I said. "Sorry, Dr. Seidman," the driver replied, "but I was told to bring you right up to the main house." I was about to protest, but thought better of it. I waited until the car stopped by the front door. I got out and headed back down the drive. I heard the driver say, "Dr. Seidman?" I kept going. He called after me again. I ignored him. Despite the lack of rain, the grass was a green, usually reserved for rainforests. The rose garden was in full bloom, an explosion of color. I tried to hurry on, but my skin still felt as if it might rip. I slowed. This was only my third visit inside the Portman family estate. I had seen it from the outside dozens of times in my youth, and I had never visited the family plot. In fact, like most rational people, I did my best to avoid it. The idea of burying your kin in your backyard like a family pet, it was one of those things that rich people do that we regular folk could never quite grasp, or would want to. The fence around the plot was maybe 2 feet high and blindingly white. I wondered if it had been freshly painted for the occasion. I stepped over the superfluous gate and walked past the modest gravestones, keeping my eye on the dirt mound. When I reached the spot, a shudder tore through me. I looked down. Yep. A recently dug grave. No stone yet. The marker on it, printed up in wedding invitation calligraphy, read simply, "Our Monica." I stood there and blinked. Monica. My wild-eyed beauty. Our relationship had been turbulent. A classic case of too much passion in the beginning.